Thus, you must realize that you have no idea before you can know the idea. We scan across all the frequencies if we want to learn anything new. Let us begin.
What has physics done for me lately?
Furthermore, the equation E is equal mc squared.
We have now acquired a fateful power to alter and to destroy nature.
That's like when you're in physics and you get a dream out saying, oh, this is a physics excursion.
Science. What is it all about?
The whole of human history all falls in the dust of one stroke of the nail file. You can't really get to grips with evolution unless you realize what an enormous amount of time.
Our own planet is only a tiny part of the vast cosmic tapestry, a starry fabric of worlds yet untold.
You're tuned into what can only be described as the best radio station on this blue dot we call Earth. It is, of course, 4ZZZ. Be it on your conventional wireless radio by tuning into the classic frequency of 102.1 FM, digital devices such as DAB or smart speaker, listening via the Community Radio Plus app, or streaming us live from our sensational website at 4ZZ and another Z.org.au. And of course, you can always listen back to us, or any 4ZZZ show for that matter, using the Ingenious On Demand feature, also found at that URL. We also now have a weekly podcast of the show that Toby curates for our listening pleasure. It's a condensed version of the show without the music, which Mum prefers. Just search for our show name, which is, of course, No Idea, spelt with a K, your weekly dose of science. And joining me today, hopefully, or eventually, will be Izzy. It's just me in the studio at the moment. For those unfamiliar with the show, we generally start the show with some weird science, then move on to some marine science, and then my personal favourite, motor racing science, also known as the motor rap. Basically, any science that has piqued our interest in the previous week or so. Rounding out the show with some space news. I'll correct the Orion space story from Zedliners later on. I usually play a bit of weird science now, but I'm still waiting for Izzy to come on in. So I'm going to talk about what happened on this day. So let me set the scene. The year is 1963, and a new film is being released in London. It was the first installment of a popular movie franchise that would become fairly successful. For those who attended, they would have heard something like this. The film is, of course, Dr. No, spelt without a K, the first of many James Bond films.
Yeah.
My God, I could talk to you guys forever. but unfortunately, unlike No Idea, I've only got 1 hour here.
You tune into 4ZZZ, and the show is No Idea, your weekly dose of science with me, Max. Full disclosure on this one, this study is from 2020, but I feel this weird science warrants some loving. A shout out to all those who enjoy a tipple of the traditional Japanese alcoholic beverage, sake. It's time to celebrate. Japanese scientists have discovered that a mutant strain of sake yeast produces high levels of the amino acid ornithine. In a study published in Metabolic Engineering, researchers from the NARA Institute of Science and Technology, which has a QS ranking of 1401+, revealed that a mutant strain of the sake yeast produces 10 times the amount of amino acid ornithine compared to its parent yeast strain. Ornithine is a non-protein-making amino acid and a precursor to two amino acids, arginine and proline. It has been found to perform several physiological functions such as reducing fatigue and improving sleep quality. The first author of the article, Masataka Ohashi, explains, "We wanted to obtain sake yeast strains with improved ethanol tolerance. During sake fermentation, the yeast is exposed to high concentrations of ethanol, which impedes yeast cell growth, viability, and fermentation. Increased ethanol tolerance in sake yeast strains could improve ethanol production and reduce fermentation time. To find ethanol-tolerant yeast strains, the researchers isolated mutants that accumulated in proline, which can alleviate ethanol toxicity. They also conducted a genome sequencing and performed brewing tests, that's the fun bit, with various sake yeast strains. It should be noted that sake tastings were mandatory among the researchers. I sort of added that bit. They successfully isolated non-genetically modified yeast that produced 10 times the amount of ornithine compared with the parent strain. The yeast parent strain that is widely used in Japanese sake making already produces about 4 to 5 times more ornithine. The results of the study will hopefully contribute to the development of improved yeast strains for production of high levels of ornithine, and the strain obtained in this study could be readily applied to wine and beer brewing. Ornithine accumulating yeast strains could also be used in the production of ornithine-rich dietary supplements. The yeast isolated in the study was found to be safe in food production. The knock-on effects should lead to the development of novel strains of yeast that overproduce functional amino acids such as ornithine, proline, and branched-chain amino acids, with the idealistic hope of greatly contributing to food-related industries. And that is it for my weird science this week. You tune into 4ZZZ, and the show is No Idea with me, Max, flying solo at the moment. Hopefully Izzy will get here eventually. We usually hear a bit of marine science, and this week is no different. This will be a rebroadcast because Peter's away with Gabe at the moment. They're overseas. And Peter did this story back on the 6th. Well, we broadcast it on the 6th of April, 2022. And she titled the article as, "Are You Smarter Than an A Fish Grader?" Let's listen.
Okay, you may just have to trust me with the fact that this research is legit and I found it from a reputable source, but your friendly neighborhood marine scientist has some facts to spit today. It turns out that some species of fish, namely cichlids and stingrays, can do maths. Okay, so we knew that they were able to count and do some basic maths, but the news is that they can legit calculate things, as in add and subtract. What? And to be fair, it's in the range between 1 and 5, which is very basic, but you know what? There are humans out there who can't do that. Mainly babies, but still, we're the brainy ones, that's insane. But how do they even figure out that they can count? Much like climbing trees, fish are not known for their talents with a pen. And so now this brings us to my favourite line of the research, that is, the researchers used a method that other research groups had already successfully used to test the mathematical abilities of bees. Isn't that just spectacular? Ugh. So what does that look like? What do you do to test the mathematical abilities of bees, cichlids, and also stingrays? Well, they show them some shapes that are coloured either blue or yellow to tell them to add or subtract, and then they see two visual answers of a correct and an incorrect answer. If they swim to the correct one, you get a food reward. If they didn't, well, you swim away with zilch, zip, nada. So for example, they might show them four yellow squares. Yellow in this scenario means subtract. So then they see two options, 3 squares and 5 squares. Now you and I can immediately say the answer is 3 squares, or at least I hope you can. But what they found is that the fish knew too. They consistently picked the right answer to the question they were being asked. So the next logical question is, well, how do you know that they didn't just memorize all the combinations? So like 4 yellow squares equals 3 and 4 blue squares equals 5 and so on and so forth for all 10 combos. And that is a legit question, but the researchers preempted this problem, so they left out the number 3 from the initial calculations. And then once they had finished the learning phase where the fish were figuring out what the hell yellow meant, they introduced the 3-square variable. And what happened? Immediately the fish were able to choose the correct answer significantly often. And they made sure that they weren't just seeing choose more or choose less, but subtract 1 and add 1 by having more than 2 options. So in this scenario, the fish would see the 4 yellow squares and then be presented with 2 squares, 3 squares, and 5 squares. And they would only be rewarded if they chose 3 squares. And they passed this too. And this is a skill that isn't really to be scoffed at. As the lead author, Professor Vera Schlessel, stated, the animals had to recognize the number of objects depicted and at the same time infer the calculation rules from their color. They then had to keep both in their working memory when the original pick was exchanged for the result pictures, and then had to calculate and decide on the correct answer. Which is incredible, because they are computing without a cortex. But there is one thing that's still unknown. We don't know why these tiny fish need such mathematical abilities. Like, sure, there are things to be counted and calculated in the ocean, such as the number of eggs you have compared to the amount you probably should have. But neither cichlids or stingrays have been seen behaving in this manner. And while we probably won't know for a while, I hope to God it's so they can do little maths quizzes on the seafloor, because that would be so cute. Ah!
You tune into 4ZZZ, and the show is No Idea with me, Max. And we heard from our friendly neighbourhood marine scientist, Peter. And now we're here from the other master, Gabe. He's talking about some seagrass that they found off the coast of WA.
Well, the world has a new largest plant, and it's sitting right on the coast of WA, in a place where you would not expect to find the world's largest plant, because this thing is one of the two types of plants that lives in the ocean. It's not a mangrove, it's a seagrass. And the thing about seagrasses is that a lot like a lot of their land-based cousins, they can reproduce in two ways. They can sexually reproduce, which is a way of increasing the genetic diversity in their populations, but they can also just extend themselves. They can push out their rhizomes, which are their stems under the ground, and pop out roots down the bottom and shoots out the top and just keep on growing. And because there are these two different ways that seagrass meadows can form, there were some researchers at the University of Western Australia that wanted to see how genetically diverse this seagrass meadow that sits in Shark Bay off the coast of WA really was. And to do that, you need to use DNA. You have to test the DNA of individual organisms within these big populations. So that's exactly what they did. They went to 10 different seagrass meadows and collected samples of a ribbonweed seagrass. And then they studied 18,000 genetic markers to see how genetically related they all were to each other. What they found was that it was all one plant. There was a single plant that stretched over 180 kilometers, 200 kilometers squared of this one ribbonweed meadow that is all based off a single colonizing seedling. What made this plant even more special is that it was a polyploid. Most seagrasses are pretty much like us. They have half of their genome from each of their parents. This plant has a double chromosome, both bits of information, both sides of each chromosome from both parents, which means it's sterile. But there's also this weird effect with polyploids in nature that they seem to be pretty good at dealing with extreme environmental conditions, which this place has. Everything, temperature, salinity, it's all quite extreme for a plant to live in. And this one seems to be really well adapted to it for some reason. And because these seaweeds can grow without sexual reproduction, they can just continue growing themselves. That's exactly what this seagrass has done and kept doing. And the researchers are currently trying to figure out what these small genetic changes that they expect to find in its genetic makeup will actually be, the things that allow it to survive and thrive in such variable conditions. But then the next question is, if this thing is 180 kilometers long, how old is it? Turns out the sandy dunes of Shark Bay flooded about 8,500 years ago. That's when the sea level rose after the last ice age. And they think that the seagrass meadows would have sort of moved into that area in the few thousand years after that. Based on the size and the growth rate of this one plant, massive plant that is all based off one little seedling, they reckon it's about roughly 4,500 years old, which is not out of the realm of possibility. They know it. There's another Mediterranean seagrass which covers more than 15 kilometers, and they know that one is around probably 100,000 years old. So 4,500 year olds for this new one that is the biggest plant in the world is not as far-fetched as it may seem. So not only does this mean that Australia can now claim the largest plant in the world, it also gives us a little bit more scope to be a bit optimistic about whether these seagrasses will be resilient in the face of a changing climate in years to come. You can head to The Conversation to catch a bit more about that story.
You're tuned into 4ZZZ, and the show is No Idea with me, Max. Izzy, good morning, Izzy.
Good morning.
And Maximilian, how are you going, Maxie?
I'm going well, yourself?
Yeah, not too bad. You ready for the intro?
Let's
Everyone's hanging for the intro.
Okay, it's time for the best part of the show. Loosely defined as science, yeah, you already know. Everybody listens to 4ZZZ just to hear us talking about what Butters just did. Subscriptions just keep rolling like the tires on a car. But something tells me that our science careers won't go far. But unlike an engine, I won't keep you in suspension. We're all here to hear him talk, so let's give him attention. You're not ready for when he starts rapping. Gonna hand the mic to Max, and I'm not talking Van Stappen.
It's lights out and away we go.
Sale GP happened on the weekend. Australia was actually deducted 8 points for hitting that marker boy during the New Zealand regatta. So apart from getting a broken boat, they got 8 points deducted. So that meant that New Zealand took the lead in the whole championship for season four of Sale GP, where they raced the 50-foot catamarans around. Anyway, they were fighting in Bermuda this time, and Australia came out fighting hard on the day one with the first of three fleet races, and that saw Australia on top with a first, then another first, and then a third. Day two, and the breeze was somewhat lighter, suiting the New Zealand and Spain teams more so than Australia. The final was between Australia, New Zealand and Spain. Spain took the lead at the first mark and was eventual winner. New Zealand came home in second and Australia third. So that means there's only three rounds to go, and Australia sits second overall with New Zealand top of the leaderboard and Spain in third position. Next regatta will be for the first time ever in Canada on June 1 and 2. Izzy, F1 Academy, Academy.
Love it. Enjoyed it.
The ladies racing so around fun. Miami. English driver Abby Pulling won the first race from French racer Dorian Pun, famously got in trouble for crossing the finish line twice at full speed. During the second race in Jeddah.
Lap so nice she did it twice. Yeah.
That's how good she is. And the second race in Miami saw Pulling once again win with McLaren driver Bianca Bustamante second, which was great for McLaren because McLaren actually had a pretty good weekend, and Pun was third. She drives for Mercedes. Next round for the women will be in Spain on June 21.
Exciting.
Good track to go to that.
Mm-hmm. Spain one?
Yeah, I reckon.
Yeah.
Because that'll be the first actual proper dedicated circuit they'll race
in Barcelona.
Yeah.
And they want to have a Madrid race, don't they? They're talking. Isn't there talk that...
Is that meant to be a street or... That is meant to be a street race, circuit. Isn't it?
Yeah, through Madrid, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Really we'll take the dedicated circuits for the minute.
F1, let's do it.
Woo!
It was a sprint weekend in the US, in Miami, which means there is a single one-hour practice session to set up your car before actual racing begins. But it was business as usual up front with Max Verstappen putting his car on pole for the sprint.
He was really surprised too. He thought he did a terrible lap and it's that's P1, Max. He actually just said lol.
Yeah.
Like, he just said the quiet bit out loud there. Yeah. Like, far out. Can't stop him. He's a menace.
And he won the sprint with Charles Leclerc second and Sergio Perez in the other Red Bull third.
So yeah, pretty standard.
Pretty standard. But coming home in fourth, cue the celebrations because often forgotten Aussie Daniel Ricciardo driving the V-carb. It was amazing looking V-carb.
That was
wasn't it?
Gorgeous.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, he came home
livery.
Fourth. Mm. Yeah, yeah.
And he was so excited.
It's like he was on the podium.
Yeah, it was. Oh.
So close too.
Yes,
but I there's no way he could have kept Perez behind. I don't think.
No. The other Aussie, Oscar Piastri, finished sixth for McLaren, while Danny's teammate Yuki finished eighth, which meant all four Red Bulls were awarded points.
What do you mean all four Red Bulls?
Well,
they're completely independent teams. What are you talking about?
With that Chinese war between them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
there was also qualifying for Sunday's feature F1 race.
The big one.
And I think Ricciardo may have opted to play it safe because he started for the back of the grid, so there'd be no first corner carnage.
Oh,
which Perez almost took out.
Yeah.
Everyone. Well, took out his teammate right from the get-go.
Verstappen wasn't too impressed when he saw the replay of that in the cool-down room.
Yeah,
it was a bit shocked.
Hilarious.
I don't think it's true at all. I think what happened to Ricciardo was something that happened to a lot of drivers that weekend. Even Alonso, Lando, they had a lot of trouble switching on the soft compound Pirellis.
Yes.
Like, they're temperamental at the best of times, and for whatever reason, the track conditions at Miami just were not, like, conducive to putting the soft compound Pirellis into the window.
Mm.
And, I mean, it's a bit of an art. The teams can't actually study the tyres at all other than on a race weekend. And then sure. they have to immediately give them up. They don't even fit them themselves to the rims. They've got to give their rims
Pirelli, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, off to Pirelli.
Yeah.
So it's super secretive. And what can, like, really, as we saw with Ricciardo's qualifying performance for this sprint race, was that if you can get them in the window, get the lap in, you can really jump the field if everyone else is sort of floundering, trying to get just, like, in search of grip.
Totally. Yeah, yeah. So I have to fess up. A couple of weeks ago, we were talking about Norris.
Yes.
We were, yes.
Let me play the audio. Talking about Norris, who got second, he holds the unenviable title of most podiums without a win. I think he shares it with someone else. So come,
I think he does.
Come
yeah.
Miami, he'll be the... Because we still reckon, Maxi and I reckon that Oscar Piastri is going to have a victory before Norris ever wins a GP race.
We can dream.
It would be his luck. Like,
yeah, totally. Yeah. Anyway.
Most participation or like second place awards.
He gets a ribbon.
Yeah.
At least it's not as bad as Hülkenberg's record of literally just not being on the podium at all.
Yeah, that's right. And by Perez outbreaking himself... it did elevate Oscar Piastri up to about second, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
On, yeah, it looked really good for
yeah,
him.
Yeah, I know. I thought, oh, yes, this is going to come true.
Start standing up,
Oscar's
like, going to
win.
Yeah. Zach Brown was saying, yeah, the simulations show that this is ideal Oscar and all this.
Really, yeah. And he yeah. But his teammate, Lando Norris, had all the upgrades, and Oscar only got 50% of the upgrades, but he'll get the full upgrades come Spain, so, or whenever. Where are we going next? Italy.
Italy.
Yep. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it just happened that Lando Norris somehow got up into the lead.
Somehow.
And then there was a safety car.
Yep.
And so it all bunched them all up, but Lando had the freshest tyres of them all. And he was strong enough to hold off Max Verstappen. To win his first Formula One race after, what? I don't know how many. Do we have that stat?
I think it's 15 podiums, I want to say. 15 podiums, something like that.
And Paul...
Again, I don't know how many races, but like his stat was like the most podiums without a actual win. Like,
yeah. And we should mention that the safety car was, of course, brought out by K-Mag.
Yep, the K-Mag special.
Doing it to Logan Sargeant. So, anyway... So Norris has got the monkey off his back, the first win in Formula One. Unfortunately, Piastri's race was compromised after his front wing was broken by Sainzy.
Yeah, Sainzy, man.
He had to come in and he only finished 13th, so out of the points. He was setting the fastest lap. Who ended up doing the fastest lap? Was it Oscar?
I want to say Lando.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I want to say, but I'm not actually 100% sure.
Oscar finished in 13th, which was better than fellow Australian Danny Ricciardo, finishing in 15th. So the final podium was Lando Norris, Max Verstappen and Charles Leclerc in the Ferrari. So, yeah. And remember the celebrations was pretty good at McLaren's.
Oh, yeah.
With the Ferrari team principal coming over, Fred, with his own bottle of champagne to spray over Lando. So that was pretty good.
He's a menace. If you hand that man a champagne bottle, it's just... Like...
it's out of control.
It is.
What we saw in Melbourne anyway.
Yeah, far out.
Any more to add to the F1?
Well, I think you raised a good point about Nico Hülkenberg now holding the official record for most Grand Prix without a win. Which is 209.
But when the team turns into Audi in 2026, which he'll be driving for, he should be on the podium.
Hopefully.
Yes.
You'd think he'd sneak at least one.
You think
right?
so.
Just at least.
Yeah.
Let's do the 77 report if you want to. Or
yeah.
Okay.
I feel like there was one more bit.
Yeah.
I feel like there was one more bit we missed.
I'll do the 77 report and we'll come back to it. So F1 driver, Valtteri Bottas, who drives under the number 77. An honorary Australian, I'd like to say, finished 14th in the 19-lap sprint.
I feel like that's a bit of a bow you're drawing there.
He could get his citizenship by marrying Tiffany Cromwell.
True, okay. And that makes you Australian then, quite literally.
Yes. Yeah. Bottas then went on to finish 16th in the feature race. Clearly his kick salver needs a bit of work. It looks good, doesn't go good. Meanwhile, the Phoenix, Roman Grosjean, enjoyed a week off from racing and was in Miami. He was seen next to a green Lamborghini. Not sure if it was his. We get to see the Phoenix race again in his IndyCar this weekend at Indianapolis.
Sick.
There you
Happy
go.
Happy days. So, yeah, what I wanted to mention before was that with Lando now getting this win, the title of most podiums without a win passes back to Nick Heidfeld.
Why is that?
Because I think he... he has, like, I want to say 14 podiums.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like Lando only just got it off him, now he goes straight back to Heidfeld. So he raced for BMW Sauber and Renault, as I understand.
Gotcha.
And shout out also to the other German driver, Pascal Wehrlein.
Yes.
Who I absolutely butchered his name last week. And I also got what team he drove for in Formula One wrong.
What team was it?
It was not Haas. It was Manor.
Manor. Dude, that's going back a bit.
It is, So you can understand why I got that confused. I was just like, I'm looking at the back of the grid a bit. No, just kidding. Now, Pascal Wehrlein, he's doing very well in Formula E this year.
Nice.
And he was always sort of tapped for the Mercedes seat. There's some thinking, he's sort of like Ocon in that sort of...
So was Nico, though. Nico was...
Same with Hülkenberg, true. Anyway, I just figured I'd fix up my prior mistake.
Should we have a special article of the trials and tribulations of the American driver, Logan Sargeant, do you think? before he leaves the grid forever.
What is the latest with that? Are they...
They're holding off, yeah.
They are, but they're doing a test with Mick Schumacher.
Really?
Kimi Antonelli.
Right.
So I think they're looking to maybe replace him.
maybe after the summer break, we might see a different driver driving the Williams.
Mm. Yeah.
Interesting.
That's what I think. But they had the third chassis there in Miami this time, so that was good. So if one of them did crash...
Okay, that's a relief, I guess.
Didn't have to share the one car anymore.
Yeah, shout out to Excel for managing that chassis.
The engineer's friend.
Yeah.
Okay, that's it for the Motor App. Thanks, everyone.
What is the independent variable that makes No Idea tick? That's what I want to know.
You tune into 4ZZZ and the show is No Idea with me, Max, and Izzy. Usually we have V, we have J, we have Gabe, we have Peter. Not today. But we can. We've got a great archive of pre-records that we can delve into. And I've done such a thing again today. We're going to hear from V and J with one of their recordings that they did on the 9th of November. Well, we broadcast it on the 9th of November. They probably did it on the day too, didn't they?
They're not here, Max. I can't just roast them.
On the 9th of November, 2022. And apparently it's about fish like to gossip. Let's listen.
I think it's been well established over our tenure as No Idea contributors that all the best science news comes from the two S's, space and the sea.
This is a true fact. Both space news and marine science have their own dedicated No Idea segments, and we still end up covering news from those areas so often, because there's just so much of it and it's all so cool.
Well, I have some delightful news for you from the realm of the fishes, Jay, because it turns out they're terrible gossips.
No, really?
Yep. New research posted at the end of January by researchers from Cornell and Boston University suggests that what we previously thought were rare and anomalous instances of fish communicating were actually small examples of a way larger pattern of fish speaking to each other.
Last I checked, though, fish didn't have vocal cords. How do they speak?
They have a variety of different ways of making sound, from movements in the water to grinding their teeth, and even noise-making specializations of the swim bladder muscles. The researchers reckon that vocal communication has evolved in fish on more than 30 independent occasions. To us, their sounds don't sound like any speaking that we're familiar with. It's more like clicks and grunts, I guess. Like this.
Gnarly. So, what do fish talk about? Do they gossip? Do they discuss current events?
Most commonly, their communications relate to reproduction. These vocalizations can be for the purpose of attracting a mate, or even to signal and coordinate when they're releasing all their genetic matter into the water.
Oh, yep. Like how some species reproduce by releasing huge amounts of eggs and sperm into the water where they just sort of commingle. So, in other words, a particularly noisy ocean means...
Yep, they're all about to get down and dirty. Like this real sound bite of a groper who's in the mood.
Oh, cool. Remind me to listen into the ocean before deciding to go for a swim.
Maybe lifeguards can start giving out fish sperm forecasts.
That's it, I'm moving. Does Australia have any landlocked states?
Okay. I feel like I'm unfairly painting fish as total horn dogs. The study also canvassed other reasons for fish to chat to each other, such as to warn each other off food, to see who else is in the area, or even just to invite their friends around. And much like humans, fish sounds tend to be loudest in areas of high population density. Think of coral reefs and busy river systems like the Amazon, like our bustling cities. What I think is most interesting about this research is that scientists now think that acoustic communication evolved in fishes about 155 million years ago, which is about the same time that land animals started to evolve acoustic communication.
That is so interesting. I wonder if there were certain environmental pressures that occurred around that time that led to acoustic communication evolving both on land and in sea.
Or maybe it was aliens who came and taught our predecessors how to talk.
Aliens. My favourite answer to everything. So, okay, we've covered that waters tend to be louder the busier they are, but do we have a definitive answer to how chatty fish are? Are they as talkative as birds, for instance?
Like most things we talk about on this show, the answer is a complicated one. The researchers reckon that levels of chattiness vary wildly between fish species, of which there are over 30,000. And ultimately, this study was a meta-analysis. For the people in the back, that means that there was no original research conducted per se. Rather, the researchers just did a big review of existing research on the topic and systemically analysed them to identify trends and patterns that might give us a better understanding of fish comms as a whole. So you see, a lack of acoustic data for a certain species doesn't necessarily mean that they were uniquely quiet. It just means there's a gap in the data.
That makes sense.
As a charming little fact, though, the researchers also noticed that fish come together to create dusk and dawn choruses. Imagine that. Fishes singing together in harmony.
I bet you could make some pretty mean tracks out of those fish vocalizations. If I had to guess, if I was, say, planning to wrap up a science segment with a clip made entirely out of fish noises used with attribution from the Discover Sound in Ocean Vimeo account, I'd say it would sound a little like this.
You're tuned into 4777. The show is No Idea with me, Max, and Izzy. And of course, it's time for a bit of this.
Did it.
No Idea Space News.
All right.
So Boeing Starliner got mentioned during the 10 a.m. deadlines. Mm-hmm. The big news this week. They're ready for Starliner to launch on Monday, but it didn't, of course. It's 4 years behind schedule. $1 billion over budget. Hopefully it'll fly. NASA has always wanted two independent spacecraft capable of carrying astronauts to and from the International Space Station. The two crew members on board are Sonny Williams and Butch Wilmore. His name's Barry, by the way. Wilmore and Williams plan to spend a little more than a week aboard the space station. They hope to transfer 340 kilograms of equipment to the lab, powering down the Starliner and making sure it can be used as a safe haven for visiting long-duration crews, because usually they stay up there for about 6 months. Mm-hmm. The launch, as I said, was meant to happen Monday, but will probably happen this Friday. There's a sticky valve, oxygen valve, playing up on the Atlas V booster. So they might have to take it back to the big room and fix it up and then wheel it back out again. So that takes a bit of time.
I always worry when I don't hit deadlines, like with uni assignments. But then I look at something like this, which is 4 years behind schedule and $1 billion over budget. And I'm going,
it's not so bad.
I think, yeah.
Don't sweat the small stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
The wall of death for those. It might help to keep astronauts fit on the moon eventually when they make their way to Mars, the red planet. For those unfamiliar with the wall of death, you can either look it up on YouTube or imagine a circular wall that you have to keep running on and run fast enough so you stay horizontal to the ground.
So it's not like a mosh pit wall of death, which like
it's horizontal.
Coming together of bodies, it's more you're horizontal, which might end up if you trip in the wall of death on a mosh pit. But yeah, interesting.
It's impossible to do on Earth unless you have a motorized vehicle, like a car or a motorbike. Mm-hmm. But on the moon, things get a bit easier because your moon weight is your friend. You simply divide by six. For example, let's say I weigh, on a good day, 72 kilo. On the moon, I would weigh 12 kilo.
Whoa.
So theoretically, I should be able to run fast enough on the wall of death on the moon, the lunar wall of death, if you will, without falling into the regolith or the moon dust.
That's, don't let celebrities that hear about this. They'll move from Mozambique to moving to the moon. Oh, my God.
And they reckon an hour of exercise on the wall of death should be enough to keep your muscles in tune as if you're on back on Earth. They won't atrophy or they won't waste away, if you want to put it that way.
Interesting.
Now, that's it really for the serious space news.
Let's get to the fun stuff, shall we?
We're going to talk about Doctor Who.
Oh, yeah.
It's happening this weekend.
Whoop.
The start of season 14. And we get a double dose. We get episode 1 and 2 dropping on BBC One or Disney Plus. So get ready to get into that. Now, I was playing with my, what is that software that I use? The AI software that makes music. So you feed it some music and it fixes it up. I've forgotten what it's called now. Anyway, I fed it the original Doctor Who theme, and it came back with something like this. Spooky, eh?
Yeah. Whoa.
I think it's called Audio Diffusion or something like that. Yeah. Sort of there. This is copyright free, by the way, Toby, so don't panic.
This is like if you get, it's like, oh, Mum, I want Doctor Who. Oh, no, we've got Doctor Who at home, and it's this. It's like Wish Doctor Who.
And then season 14 has their own.
Oh, okay.
Theme.
Sick.
And I fed that into the AI, and it came back with this.
Oh, no.
More flourishing.
It's like if you put the theme in like a dryer or a washing machine and it's just like going round and round like the you just forgot to take your wallet out and it's just like hitting. Interesting.
I fed it some keywords too, like sci-fi, lush, haunting.
Okay, that explains a lot. I was wondering what prompts you used. Interesting.
Episode 1's going to be called Space Babies. And we'll see the Doctor and his new companion, Ruby, land on an isolated space station where the duo discover a baby farm run by the babes themselves. And they therefore must protect them from a threatening, prowling lower deck monster or something.
Interesting.
And the second episode, which also drops at the same time, is called The Devil's Cord. And apparently the Doctor and Ruby will meet the Beatles.
Oh.
I don't know why. Yesterday.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. That's fun and cool. Okay.
Anything to add with the Doctor Who?
No.
I was hoping Jay would have written something, but
I would be interested,
he didn't get back to me.
Hear his thoughts about this. But we'll
maybe
look forward
next week
to that. When are they dropping?
Saturday.
Saturday?
Yeah, yeah.
9 a.m.
sharp. Sydney time.
All right.
Yeah, Australian Eastern Standard Time, yeah.
We'll have to listen.
And we'll have the feedback next week.
Yeah.
Next Wednesday. Sounds good.
With the actual themes.
The key word being difficult to imagine because we're constrained by our own existence. Like, this is so frustrating me when we talk in absolutes when we have no idea. Like, we're not that smart. We're pretty stupid. There's plenty of things we don't know. You don't know what you don't know. Just, like, yet, babe, yet.
Yeah.
You're tuned to 4ZZZ and the show is No Idea, but not for much longer.
No, Gabe,
Izzy, sign
us out.
No, where's Gabe to sign us out? Thanks, everyone. Thanks for all the rebroadcasts. Thanks, Izzy, for coming in and doing the motor rap with me. That was good. Thanks,
welcome.
Maximilian, for doing it as well. And thank you for joining in with the Doctor Who AI segment of the show.
And we need like an AI Gabe or something to like sign us out.
That would be good. We should just do that.
Feels a little,
I'll do
raw
it for them. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's back next week anyway, so. Yeah.
Well. Anyway, all that to look forward to.
And
this
did
week
you hear my sake, the weird song?
I did sake hear your sake.
That
yeah
was for Gabe and Peter because that's where they are at the
in
moment.
Japan.
Enjoying the sake.
Yep.
And we'll speak to you next week.
See ya.
I'm a goddamn marvel of modern science.